to the Queensbound F local train. The next stop is...
This is the Culinary Historians of New York.
And for that, I'd like to now introduce Kathy Kaufman, our chair, who will tell you a little bit more about our organization, the Culinary Historians of New York.
Okay, thank you so much, Christine. We are very, very excited to be initiating our programs online at this point. Out of necessity is coming something that I think is going to be very exciting for the future of the organization. So welcome to you all, and we would love your feedback on the programs and your experience as we hope a very active participant. A couple of ways of asking questions in this format, which of course is a little bit different from our normal in-person events. We are setting up the chat where, if you so choose, you can post questions during the discussion, during the presentation. Once the presentation is completed, we will have a Q&A period. We would like to spotlight you to get a little more interactivity going on. However, if you would prefer not to appear on camera, that's fine too. Just say, don't spotlight me, but someone ask the question on my behalf. We can do that. So we will have ways of doing it. Also, there is the raise hand function, which if you look at the bottom of your screen, you ought to be able to see several icons under the participants listing, and those should give you a little blue hand that you would be able to raise if you want to ask a question during our Q&A period if you haven't put it in the chat. It's really very simple, very informal, and we're all learning as we go along, so let's not get too stressed out about it. Just a couple of housekeeping details. We've got programs set up in October and November. So mark your calendars. Monday, October 19th, we have Brian Dott, who is going to be talking about the chili pepper in China. And then Monday, November 16th, we will have Ben Catcher talking about the dairy restaurant. They are both very engaging presenters talking about very interesting topics. So we hope that we will see you then. I'm now going to turn over to Linda Palacio, who is one of our board members, the host of A Taste of the Past on Heritage Radio Network. And she has invited our presenter to speak to us, Marcia Chatelain. So Linda, let me turn it over to you for the introductions.
Thanks, Kathy. I'm really excited to do this. First of all, I'm really excited because this is, you know, all new territory for many of us. But to have Marcia here, because I think that, well, so much has been in the news recently too about McDonald's and their business practices. But her book, Franchise, The Golden Arches in Black America, recently came out, and it really highlights fast food in the Black community. And we titled it, How Does Fast Food Become Black Food? Which hopefully, Marcia, you're going to to address and let us know that. But, you know, fast food restaurants are concentrated in some of the country's lowest income and most segregated areas. And the question is, how did that happen? And according to the Centers for Disease Control, African Americans are more likely to eat fast food than any other racial group in America, even though Americans as a whole, in my opinion, eat way too much fast food. And that is often seen in, you know, associated with the high rates of obesity and diabetes and heart disease. But our guest speaker, Marcia Chatelain, will pretty much address all that, but she says we really have to look beyond that. We have to look beyond to discover what are the social and economic reasons behind all this. And in her this book, Franchise, The Golden Arches in Black America, she uncovers what she calls, and I like this, the hidden history, the hidden history of the relationships between the struggle for civil rights and the expansion of the fast food industry, which we know has just blown up. Marcia is professor of history and African American studies at Georgetown University, and she's a leading voice on the history of race, education, and food culture in America. In fact, she organized a social media response to the killing of Michael Brown in right after Ferguson. I mean, she has a lot of influence, and her voice is put to really good use. Her previous book was Southside Girls, Growing Up in the Great Migration. And it is my pleasure to welcome her and to present to you Marcia Shetlin. Marcia. So Marcia, I want you, with all these, there's so many topics in your book to cover. I mean, I wouldn't want to slight one or the other by pinpointing them. But you have called this a troubling success story. So I hope that you touch on that as well as a hidden and surprising history. So what Marcia and I have talked about, maybe if you could just walk us through the book a bit first, and then we'll all hit you up with whatever questions, you know, pop to mind, and I have a whole list of them. So Marcia.
Thank you so much, Linda. And thank you so much, Culinary Historians of New York, for this event. My book came out in the winter of 2020, and I was on my way to New York for an event with Marion Nessel, who I believe is here in the audience, who was kind enough to blurb my book. I was so excited. And I got a phone call that I don't think we can do big events in New York, but if it's 50 people, I think we'll be okay. And then it was 25. And then soon after I arrived in New York City, I was told I had to go home. And so New York was actually the last place other than my apartment that I visited. And I can't wait to return to New York, but I'm glad that so many New Yorkers are here with me today. Thank you so much for an opportunity to talk to a group of people who understands why food matters and why the stories we tell about what we consume and the conditions under which we consume them are so important for understanding a myriad of issues. If I may, I'm going to share my screen and walk you through the book a little bit, and then we'll open up for questions and answers. And so I will do as I do every week with my students at Georgetown University. I will share my screen and I will present, and then we can go from there. So the title, you can't see are you seeing a large screen?
No.
No, oh, I know why. Oh, we are all learning how to share. Okay, I'm gonna stop the share, and I'm gonna do it differently. Share screen, and now we'll share the app. Has this improved your view?
Excellent. Yep,
perfect.
So, my book examines a set of relationships. And for those of us who study food and food culture, we know that for many of us, food is more than what we taste. It's what we feel when we have these associations. And so one of the entry points for my research for Franchise began with someone you may be familiar with. For those of you who are not old enough to remember, this is a former president. His name was Bill Clinton. It seemed like very different times when he was president. So when Bill Clinton ran for president in 1992, moments like this were often fodder for ridicule and a little bit of judgment, as the president very much enjoyed fast food. And one of the things that I thought was really fascinating about Bill Clinton's love of a Big Mac, or this looks like he just went for a jog and then decided to go to McDonald's, which I'm sure many people do. But one of the characterizations of Bill Clinton was made by the writer Toni Morrison in the pages of The New Yorker in 1998. And in that essay, she described Bill Clinton as the first Black president. And this comment was often repeated after the election of the actual first Black president, Barack Obama. But very few people actually have read the entire text of what Toni Morrison was talking about. She was describing the relentlessness in the inauguration hearings of Bill Clinton. And she said the ways in which Congress was pursuing him was reminiscent of the ways that African Americans were pursued in the justice system. And she said, in many ways, Bill Clinton possessed many of the tropes of Blackness. He was from the South. He enjoyed playing the saxophone and jazz music. And she called him a junk food loving boy from Arkansas. And one of the things I thought was really kind of provocative about this claim is that everyone around the world is probably familiar with fast food. Many, if not all Americans at this point have been to McDonald's or at least knows what it is. But what is it about McDonald's and what is it about fast food that we index as Black? And in studying this relationship, what I was most intrigued with were images in which McDonald's was at the center of pivotal moments in African-American history. This is a picture from Ferguson, Missouri in 2014, where Michael Brown was killed on August 9th. And Ferguson was a critical turning point for some of the conversations that we still struggle with today about the pervasive legacies of racism and the inability for some communities to feel safe and protected. And moments like this from the news coverage in Ferguson, Missouri, were interesting to me because publications like Eater, I believe the New York Times had a mention of it, was the fact that this McDonald's is one of the few places that remained open during the unrest. And in fact, it created a very strange site where reporters would go to the McDonald's to use Wi-Fi to file stories. Two reporters from the Washington Post were arrested at this McDonald's for trespassing as they were trying to close the restaurant during some of the toughest nights of people out on the street. And the McDonald's was also the place where a lot of police officers were engaged in shift changes. And I remember reading an article that essentially said, even though people have a lot of criticism of McDonald's, in this moment, it was like a beacon. And for someone who has been studying McDonald's for close to a decade, I thought to myself, well, this isn't actually a very new story. In fact, moments like this in 1968, after Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination, was a pivotal moment in the relationship between African Americans and McDonald's. And in fact, when I think about chaos and I think about Black America, fast food often comes to mind, and I'll tell you why. Growing up in Chicago, I always noticed this plaque outside of a McDonald's restaurant on Chicago's South Side in the Woodlawn neighborhood. And the plaque says, on December 21st, 1968, this location was franchised to the first McDonald's African-American owner-operator. As a historian, I noticed plaques and markers of commemoration, and this one I thought was really interesting. What makes it special for an African-American to franchise a McDonald's? And in fact, what I discovered as I was writing this book is that this moment in 1968 was a critical turning point around the issue of what would be the future of the civil rights movement. Would African-Americans continue Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy in the search for beloved community, in organizing against poverty and being critical of the Vietnam War? Or would they turn to an ideology that was becoming increasingly important in conversations about the future, and that was the idea of Black capitalism? Would African Americans be better off if they spent their collective energies pursuing business and enterprise as an entryway to civil rights? And at this very moment, something else was happening: the explosion of franchising in the United States. Most of us associate franchising with the fast food industry, but a number of types of businesses are franchised, from the senior center that you may use as a family for elder care, daycare centers for children, UPS stores. If you've ever stayed in a Hilton hotel, it may have been part of a franchise group. And in the United States, we have about 250,000 fast food restaurants, and they represent a third of all franchise businesses. For those of you who do not own franchises, I will describe them very briefly. I describe them in a very Freudian way in my book. A franchise is like a family system in which the parents set all the rules, but the kids earn all the money. And that is a franchise in a nutshell. So the book. So the book starts with the early history of McDonald's, and it starts with Richard and Maurice McDonald's, the founder of McDonald's, as we know, McDonald's in its early stages, before it became under the leadership of Ray Kroc. The two things that I think are important to understand about the building of McDonald's. The entire infrastructure for the fast food industry was predicated on the racially exclusionary policies and practices of early 20th century America. The accessibility of bank loans to white entrepreneurs at the expense of African-American ones. The building of fast food as an experience for suburban families in neighborhoods that had racially excluded African Americans. The building of the highway system, which essentially bifurcated or destroyed African American neighborhoods in its construction and its reliance on eminent domain and slum clearance. And so in many ways, when we think about the way that McDonald's represents some of the impulses of mid-century American life, car culture, the transition of families with a little bit of disposable income to be able to enjoy McDonald's, the marketing to children of family-friendly foods and places. In the background is an incredible history of African Americans looking in from the inside, from the outside. The other note that I make in the book about the relationship between McDonald's and civil rights is that I uncover a number of instances in which McDonald's is the target of protests that we often associate with brands that are no longer with us. So we think about Woolworths or Katz's Drugs as targets of anti-segregation protests by groups like the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee or the Congress of Racial Equality, but McDonald's was actually part of it. And one of the things I found incredibly curious was how McDonald's got written out of that narrative so quickly. McDonald's in states like Arkansas, Tennessee, North Carolina, they were all targets of major civil rights activity, but we really don't think of them within that frame. And one of the reasons why I think that's the fact is that because after the introduction of African Americans into franchising of McDonald's restaurants, McDonald's started to graft themselves onto a narrative of progressive civil rights. The first African-American franchise owner is in the center of this picture from the Chicago Defender. His name was Herman Petty. And soon after Herman Petty entered McDonald's franchising and a number of African-American men went into this industry, McDonald's started saying things like, we are one of the greatest kind of equal opportunity mechanisms in the United States. And while McDonald's probably wasn't incredibly moved by the civil rights movement, what they were reacting to was something that I also introduced in the book, and that's economic white flight. Many of us who are familiar with the history of real estate and housing in the United States associate white flight with the reaction of white homeowners to the diversification of their neighborhoods. And we know that that has had a long-term impact on real estate values and school funding, but there was also an economic flight from cities because of race. And when business owners shuttered their businesses and left, in their place came African-American entrepreneurs. And in the case of McDonald's franchises, when white franchise owners no longer wanted to do business in predominantly Black areas, McDonald's gave them an exit strategy to reconvene in the suburbs, and African Americans were able to replace them. And so throughout the book, I found some very interesting ways in which the relationship between African Americans and franchising was often expressed in similar terms to the real estate market. So, as McDonald's is expanding in African American communities, it's confronted with a series of challenges to its presence. In Cleveland, Ohio, McDonald's is the target of a boycott of an umbrella Black organization called Operation Black Unity. that is challenging McDonald's presence in Black communities, not because of the food or because of racial segregation or discrimination, but because they believe that only African Americans should franchise locations in Black neighborhoods if they are going to profit through so many African American consumers. In Portland, Oregon, the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense is accused of bombing a McDonald's in retaliation for refusing to participate in its free lunch program for children. And their argument is, if McDonald's is going to be in our community, they have to be a citizen as well. Other critiques of McDonald's came from cities like Philadelphia in the Ogun's neighborhood, where African Americans said that they weren't necessarily anti-fast food, but they wanted to be able to have a voice in how a business appeared in their community. Some African American celebrities started to compete with McDonald's as African American franchise owners became very rich because they were running really profitable restaurants. Celebrities like Muhammad Ali started Champburger out of Miami, Florida, to say that, in fact, if you really want to buy Black, you should buy from Champburger and not Ronald McDonald. And Mahalia Jackson opened a series of fast food restaurants called Mahalia Jackson's Glory Fried Chicken. And again, these were attempts to try to create authentic Black fast food brands. And so in all of this critique of how McDonald's operates in African American communities, people were not only expressing their opinions about McDonald's, they were indexing their frustrations with the culture of the 1970s, in which there had been a decade of all of these civil rights victories, and African Americans were finding that it did not improve the quality of their lives. Into the 1980s, we see more and more visible culture that's created through McDonald's and McDonald's advertising. McDonald's is often heralded as being one of the first companies to hire an exclusively African-American run and operated advertising firm in order to create ads like this that were reflective of African-American families, rather than previous practices of some brands where they would just swap out Black models for white models. McDonald's also started to get into the business of branding itself as a supporter of Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy, which is an interesting framing, to say the least. And so I argue that they're one of the first corporate sponsors of the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, which, for those of you who remember, was incredibly controversial after its adoption in 1983. McDonald's sponsors gospel music tours, the American Double Dutch League, which came out of New York City and became a strong presence in athletics through the All-American basketball game. And so these examples really represent the ways that African Americans became familiar with McDonald's through non-food means. And I bring up this point because I think that as nutritionists and public health advocates want to intervene in the volume of fast food that communities eat, they have to consider the ways that McDonald's has created special experiences and affective approaches to the consumer market that make it particularly challenging to critique the food. Into the 1980s, McDonald's becomes targets of a series of accusations, and the recent lawsuit that a group of African-American franchisees have filed against McDonald's have all sorts of resonance of these cases that I talk about in my book. And so the charge is that African-American franchise owners are limited in their capacity to expand their wealth through McDonald's ownership. And so as these contestations about racial discrimination are being worked out between McDonald's and franchise owners, civil rights organizations like the NAACP are becoming mediators between McDonald's and aggrieved franchise owners. And so you start to see the ways that the legacy civil rights organizations are actually promoting and playing a hand in the expansion of fast food outlets in inner city communities. The National Black McDonald's Operators Association also plays a hand in working with civil rights organizations for recruiting more franchise owners And again, these are the origins, these connections among very influential Black organizations in creating the saturation in certain communities that we see today. And the final chapter ponders this question. This is a picture from Los Angeles in 1992, after the uprising that followed the acquittal of the officers who were responsible for the beating of motorist Rodney King. And after that week in Los Angeles started to calm down, the CEO of McDonald's at the time, Ed Renzi, issued a statement that said, due to McDonald's socially progressive interventions in African American communities since 1968, none of our stores were harmed during this unrest. And I thought to myself, first of all, what a wildly inappropriate claim. But even if this were true, for McDonald's to feel so confident in its position vis-a-vis African Americans, to say that it was such a member of its community that it wasn't a target of any of the animus or frustration of the time, I thought was so strange. And that led me down a rabbit hole to really think about how this relationship has been constructed and what was it about McDonald's and its residents that it could feel confident in making that claim, and that that claim could be believed and has been recycled in so many places that I've heard the story narrated by so many people. And so when we think about the future of fast food and we think about the ways that the public has grown in its consciousness about the consequences of fast food because of the work of people like Marion Nestle, because of the work of Michelle Obama when she was first lady, because of popular cultural texts like Fast Food Nation and the documentary Supersize Me, how are we going to rethink our strategies of how we understand fast food consumption beyond the idea that it is the food of people who are reckless or negligent or do not understand nutrition? And how do we analyze the roles of corporations in the lives of people, particularly vulnerable populations who are often constricted in the choices that they can make? And as McDonald's continues to be the target of scrutiny about its labor practices, how do we understand it as an entity that leans on a certain kind of history about its engagement about race to absolve itself from responsibility for creating a more just workplace? After the George Floyd summer, corporations created all sorts of messaging about its commitment and its solidarity with Black Lives Matter. And when McDonald's did the same thing using social media, they talked about how it's their Black workers matter and their Black franchisees work, franchisees matter. But at the end of the day, McDonald's shape-shifting in order to suggest that they are on the side of racial justice is actually not an invention of 2020, but has a longer and, as I presented, troubling history. And with that, I would love to hear the questions and comments from the audience. I'm going to stop sharing my screen right now.
Well, that, as I told you, there are so many, there's so many different topics to focus on that are all very, very important. And that was an incredible rundown of everything in the book. I loved it. It was terrific. And I'm going to pick up on the labor in a minute, because I have a couple of points to make about that and the comfort zone, the labor, you know, chances for employment. But we have a question from one of our viewers, from Therese Nelson. Hi, Therese. I didn't know you were here. And she was wondering, I would have her, you ask the question, Therese.
Hi, good to see you.
Hey, Dr. Challen. Yeah, you know I love your book so much. But I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about this sort of civil rights framework that you explore, because we don't talk enough about like how like Urban League, NAACP, and a lot of like Black Lives orgs kind of help to sort of, you know, guide that kind of narrative.
Absolutely. So, you know, 1968 is often, unfortunately, taught to students as the end of the civil rights movement. But in many ways, 1968 was, I think, a reconsideration of the framework of civil rights. And so Jesse Jackson very famously says to African-American audiences, we have to, you know, we are now done with civil rights. We now have to think about our silver rights. And there's many ways to critique that and say, you know, is this a case of people selling out or abandoning their ideals? But I think a more nuanced and compassionate view of it is that if you look at the civil rights victories between 54 and 68, you have the desegregation of schools, you have the passage of the Civil Rights Act, you have the passage of the Voting Rights Act, and then in 68, you have the Fair Housing Act, which gets passed in the wake of Martin Luther King's assassination. People's lives aren't changing radically. They aren't changing as radically as those changes come. And so I think that the pivot towards economic power and economic development was in many ways a gesture of kind of exhaustion with trying to use these kind of federal measures to improve people's lives. And it also was met by the Nixon White House that was on board with this. I mean, President Nixon is fascinating because he is so anti-civil rights, but he knows just the thing to do to try to get civil rights allies. And what he says is, don't worry, we're not going to use the might of the federal government to really do affordable housing. We're really not going to do, an end to school desegregation. We're not going to support busing, and we're going to spend all our time disrupting Black radical groups, and we're going to spy on everyone. But this is what I will do: Black businesses. And so he starts creating these various ways through the Small Business Administration and the Office of Minority Business Enterprise that incentivizes organizations like McDonald's to recruit African-American franchise owners. And if you are listeners of the podcast Proof, I just did two episodes for them for America's Test Kitchen, one about disappearing franchises, which should be my next book. But the second episode is about an ex-football player named Brady Keyes. Brady Keyes is able to access $9 million worth of loans and grants through the Nixon White House to create his own fried chicken franchise called All Pro. And then he becomes a franchisee for Kentucky Fried Chicken and Burger King. And his son said to me that Nixon talked to his dad directly and said, I need you to open up one of your restaurants in Cleveland so I can point to that for Ohio voters, so I can tell Black people in Ohio I've done something for them. And I think it's very easy from the perch of 2020 to say, you know, this was so bad and this was so reductive, but African Americans have long used business ownership as a route to power, so that wasn't new. And also, from the view of 1968, from someone who had grown up in segregation in Austin, Texas, who couldn't even play football for the University of Texas because of race, the President of the United States is going to give you a pathway to all of this money, and you're going to think about redeveloping your community. And so I think it's important to note, by the standards of the time, this was a great idea. This was really, really going to change things. It was going to provide jobs and a pathway, but people couldn't see around the corner that we've seen about the impact of fast food. Thank you for your question.
You know, and that brings me to a point that I wanted to ask you and have you discuss a little bit, and that was, you know, back when McDonald's was starting up as one of the first fast food chains, there weren't a lot of restaurants where African American people could go and feel comfortable. And not only could they feel comfortable in McDonald's, but then you also mentioned, as you've already mentioned, you know, they had job opportunities. And this was early on when they were first starting out the franchises. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Right. So the two kind of sales points for bringing McDonald's into communities. The first one was that fast food is a delivery vehicle for food that can, that doesn't have baked into it too many codes of conduct. And so McDonald's was selling the experience of going to McDonald's to African Americans in ways that we bristle at because it is offensive. But I think it's important to note, in some of their advertising from the 70s, they say, McDonald's, you don't have to dress up, you come as you are, you don't have to tip, you will be, you know, you'll be welcomed here. And what that's signaling is that for African Americans in the 1970s, you know, they've only had about 6 years of federal protection to walk into any restaurant they want and not be subject to humiliation or even worse, violence. And, you know, restaurant attendance was something that was so poignant. Initially, I was going to write a book about civil rights workers' memoirs of going to restaurants, but there really was no book there. God bless Susan Ferber of Oxford University Press, who said, well, I don't see how this is a book, and it wasn't. But the point I was making was that if you talk to African Americans of a certain generation, they will remember the first time they went inside of a restaurant without fear. The late John Lewis told this incredible story to students at Georgetown University a few years ago about eating at a Chinese restaurant before the March on Washington and his mind being blown. You know, like he'd never kind of seen anything like this before. Melba Patillo Beals, one of the members of the Little Rock Nine, she just talks about eating in an integrated restaurant the summer before she integrated Little Rock Central High School and just being blown away. And then later being embarrassed when Thurgood Marshall can't eat in a restaurant in Little Rock and he has to eat a greasy hamburger. So these, the social relationship between an individual and comfort and eating is so important. And so when I was on my book tour, I had a stop in Kansas City. And a woman told me the story of going to McDonald's for ice cream. And this was so exciting because she had grown up in the segregated South and her grandmother wouldn't let them go to an ice cream store that had a colored window. And so they made ice cream at home. And so she says, I remember I went on a date to a McDonald's and I had an ice cream and this was a big deal. And so the reason why I mentioned these things is that this is really important. And in the ways that I think fast food can be demeaned because of the quality of the food, or the ways that we sometimes don't recognize the incredible talent of fast food workers because they're cooking the same things, but they're cooking it quickly. And for a lot of people, the experience of being in a fast food restaurant can be incredibly meaningful for communities. And the thing about jobs is that McDonald's, African-American owned McDonald's, some of them were extensions of foundations that were created for the development, youth development programs in communities that didn't have these resources. McDonald's that are African-American owned, they link up with federal job programs in cities to create first jobs because the youth unemployment rate for African-American teenagers was over 50% in the 1960s and 70s. And after the oil embargoes, there are no jobs to be had. And so one of the things that concerns me about this history, while I think it's important for us to recognize it, no corporation should be providing these resources in any community. And the sleight of hand that happens during this time is that African Americans are told, well, your McDonald's will provide all these resources. Meanwhile, people are saying, well, but doesn't the state have a responsibility to provide these resources? And so you start to see why these relationships become so complicated.
All right, we have a couple of questions to catch up on here. And the first one is from Shane Figueroa. Shane, would you like to ask your question?
Sure, let me pull up so I remember the exact wording. Yeah, thank you. This was really, really great. And I was just kind of wondering, if in your research you discovered what the percentages of McDonald's franchise owners today that are African-American, Black, and if there's any actual challenges coming from other chains in terms of popularity, either historically or at present. Now, you mentioned some of the celebrity chains that kind of probably petered out rather quickly, but is there any sustained kind of like combat other than Burger King?
So currently there are fewer than 300 African-American franchise owners. I think it's in the 260s range. And this is a big issue of contention. And this is one of the issues that's brought up in the lawsuit. And if you could get I actually have a copy I can share with you. If you read this filing, it is bananas. It's so fascinating. That's all I'll say. I'm not involved in the lawsuit. And I did not help prepare the filing. I just want to say that. But I wonder if a few people did read franchise, I think, in order to prepare it. All of that is to say, the numbers have been declining over the past two decades. And McDonald's used to really pride itself on this African-American franchise core. It never really crept up to more than maybe 5 to 6% of the entire system. I don't think it ever got significant, but the franchisees had such an outsized role in concentrated Black areas that you started to also believe that McDonald's was a Black brand because the face of these franchisees would be so known to the public. And I think one of the greatest racial distinctions in America is, do you know someone who owns a McDonald's franchise? I would go to talks and, you know, white audience members would say, like, how would I know who franchised the McDonald's I go to? And African-Americans would say, oh my God, the guy who owned my franchise, you know, he did the scholarship program and I used to hear him on radio telling you to, you know, fill out your census. It's the positionality of these franchise owners that I think is really big. And the issue of other brands, McDonald's did such a good job with this concerted effort, and they started to see the profitability of these communities very quickly, and other brands followed suit. So Burger King was always on the heels, Kentucky Fried Chicken, Taco Bell to some extent. But what happens with these franchise programs are the same allegations in all the systems, that there's redlining, that African Americans can only get stores in certain neighborhoods. Those neighborhoods have higher carrying costs for business. And then recently in this lawsuit, the franchisees who are filing suit against McDonald's say that on average, their stores make $60,000 less per month than their white counterparts. And I anecdotally heard all sorts of stories of people, not just McDonald's, but people who are pursuing the other franchises, which I will not name on this call. And they talk about the racial discrimination in passing the test to actually get a franchise. So this is something that this community is always engaging with.
Which is interesting to note too, because you've often said in comments that the Black owned the franchises produced so much better than the white owned franchises by and large, most part, like 25% more profitable.
Yes, and then the other kind of challenge that people say is that McDonald's makes these requirements on its franchises that then the Black owned stores are at a disadvantage for. So whether it's the transition to 24-hour window, all day breakfast, digital screen ordering, all of these upgrades become the responsibility of the franchisee, all day Wi-Fi, all of these things. And after you write a book like this, when you see a fast food brand offering a new product, all I can think about is the supply chain. I'm thinking, gosh, how are they gonna get all these chickens to the store? And all day breakfast created a real challenge for some franchise owners in terms of supply chain and supply costs.
Sure, I imagine. We have another question, and this one is on some of the advertising. You were talking about the advertising earlier. And the question is, did McDonald's advertising, especially the ads that introduced white Americans to Double Dutch or to the centrality of family dinner in Black households, make any positive change, even if the ads were really meant to sell burgers?
I love that question because I think that there's a way that McDonald's was at the forefront of the idea of the crossover marketing strategy. So, you know, we know that markets are segmented, and McDonald's really tried to take advantage of that segmentation with ads featuring African-American models and, you know, kind of story scaffolding. But then they started to bring African-American celebrities into their campaigns, and they saw the profitability. And, you know, for those of us who grew up in the 80s and 90s, I mean, they were really big stars. Michael Jordan, did ads for McDonald's, and I don't know if it's because I grew up in Chicago, but that was a really big deal. And then Patti LaBelle did McDonald's commercials. I mean, there's a whole cohort of African-American celebrities, and I think that did make a difference. And, you know, these ads that were supposed to cross over were very consciously done in Black cultural forms. So there would be, you know, a rapping Ronald McDonald, or there would be, there was a time that they had a kind of, what would they call it, Mac the Knife, these kind of, these forms that are for everybody, but they have these like Black origins. And I think it's interesting that they understood that that could work. But if you were to look at the body of work that they did in Black America, I think it is important to note that these were really important first opportunities for a lot of Black creatives. And I have a million critiques of McDonald's, but I know that that advertising world yielded so many opportunities for African-American musicians, backup singers, composers, lyricists, people who would not have had those routes.
Well, in that same vein, there's a question from Rochelle. Rochelle is actually the editor and founder of Island and Spice magazine. Just wanted to give that a little plug. Hi, Rochelle. It's an interesting question, just following up on what Marcia was saying.
Yeah, thank you for the plug there, Linda. I appreciate it. And as I'm following what you're saying, and you gave wonderful examples of like the history of McDonald's and the relationship with the Black community and how it really worked its way into the Black community. And I'm just trying to understand some of where is the line when it for franchises and even for businesses at large, where is that line when behavior is when you're exploiting a community? Or are you actually providing access to opportunity? If you can kind of explain that a little bit, I think a lot of people can even look at what we're doing right now and trying to understand what that fine line is in terms of providing access for people of color. But sometimes there's also this, you know, awkward dance where you're exploiting a group of people. So can you explain that and how the franchise danced that line over the decades?
You know, I think it's definitely a both and, because all of these things are predicated on systems that are broken. So, Richard Nixon could support Black capitalism because there's no challenge to segregation. So it works, right? So you can tell people who are conservative on civil rights, don't worry, this will not disrupt the status quo. And you can tell people on the left that this is empowering, right? People should have access to ownership, but it doesn't interrogate any of the premises of this idea about capitalism or private ownership or what exactly a business person should do. And so from my perspective, you know, when I talk to people who own franchises, who say things like, I'm literally the only place where a person can get a job if they have a felony conviction record. I am the place where, you know, young people who need to figure, you know, out a work situation, they can come to me. That is valuable. And I don't discredit that, but I think to myself, well, should we take a step back and say, like, why should a McDonald's have that role? It's weird. It's weird to me that any place that's tasked with selling a burger is then involved in the kind of social outcomes of people. It's too risky because ultimately, in order for that opportunity to be extended, there has to be exploitation of someone or something. And so I think that the line is, at what point do we start to imagine a different world in which we don't use private capital to serve the interest or to respond to the problems of the public good? Because we actually have a way to make sure that people have healthcare without having to be employed. And we actually have mechanisms in which young people can get the resources they need for themselves and their schools. And we have a way to fund senior centers if we want to. It's called our taxes. And so, you know, some people ask me in interviews, like, do you want to abolish McDonald's? And I was like, you know what? No one's going to join me in the abolition of McDonald's. But I don't want McDonald's success in a Black community to determine the quality of Black people's lives. I want people to just have a hamburger and be done with it, right? But if McDonald's pays enough taxes and we don't have to rely on philanthropy, then we don't kind of find ourselves having to shift and kind of like squint and try to, it's important, but what is it? You know, what is it? And so I think, you know, a lot of people are asking if 2020 is like 1968, and there's a lot of reasons to say no, but one of the things you do see in the kind of pivot towards diversity and inclusion, let's bring in new voices. I think all of us, as people of color in different industries, there's a deep interest in what we're doing. And, you know, a lot of questions like, we've been doing this the whole time. I've been here and I've been working. But I think that kind of mode of how do we respond to like now, but are we imagining sustainable change so that we don't have to see opportunity as so connected to tragedy or chaos, right? Like
the another element there when talking about, you know, the goal for many brands in this country is to become a household name, Mm-hmm. And to become a household name, you have to sort of equate yourself to this idea of Americana. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the pursuit of American equality, and you take that on. And so in terms of the social responsibility of private dollars going farther, providing scholarships, sponsoring the local, you know, baseball team and such like that, the local football team. If you're a business that's making billions of dollars in local communities off the backs of, you know, workers going in and every day feeding this country, isn't there a commitment? If you are pursuing what it means to be America and committed to being showing up in people's homes and on their dinner tables every day, then isn't there also a commitment to then go above and beyond and serve these communities by providing access to opportunities with your private dollars?
I would argue that the best way to do that is just to pay your fair share of taxes and not have to pick and choose what your commitment looks like. So I don't like the idea of, you know, like all these billions of dollars being made and there's kind of no, there's no like reinvestment in kind of civil society. But my concern is that when we put it within the category of philanthropy, benevolence, instead of kind of common good, what starts to happen is that, you know, very early on in the book, I talk about these conflicts McDonald's had with African-American community groups, and they say, well, we give to the NAACP. It's like, what are you talking about, right? How does one response get to kind of the heart of the critique? And so I think that in my ideal world, McDonald's, you know, the way they tell Black athletes to stick to, you know, stick to sports, stick to burgers, because that's what you know how to do. What you don't know how to do is deliver justice. And so I would love to live in a context where there are no like shortcuts, or there's no other way around it. So you're paying into, you know, paying into a mechanism so all your workers have healthcare. You know, one of the responses McDonald's did after COVID was they had this huge commercial that said, you know, now we're having paid sick leave for our employees. And then you look at the tiny asterisk and you're like, for our company-owned stores, fewer than 10% of McDonald's restaurants are company-owned. Mm-hmm. And so you think, okay, so you know that paid sick leave is a thing. Can you imagine a world in which there's a cost-sharing mechanism, or better yet, there are rules that say you can't not have that, so that we don't have to kind of wait for McDonald's to try to take the temperature of the nation before they move forward? Because I think that this idea of like racial justice can only come in the form of repair for immediate harm instead of a bigger strategy is the thing that I think is a struggle. And at the same time, I meet people who are just so grateful that a McDonald's owner extended themselves the way they did, and the ways that they contributed to their schools and communities. And that's the tension that I think that this book and, you know, my research really rests in.
Yeah, I think, and you said, you know, are they, you know, the heroes or the villains? Well, that mean that actually was meant for fast food in general, but certainly for McDonald's. And obviously McDonald's is not the only fast food company that is in there, but it's just such a prime example because it was one of the first, and it's certainly the largest, and there are so many other fast food companies. But along those lines, the opposite, and that's doing what they do well, but should they be doing it, is a question from Abby Katz. Abby?
Hi, my name is Abby, and you kind of started touching on this a little bit, but my question was mostly about the embeddedness of these fast food companies along with other like snack food companies and sugar sweetened beverage companies, obviously in Black and Brown communities, is kind of prevalent in a lot of different ways. And I'm curious whether you can speak to at all how these companies are now reconciling with the way that they've contributed to racism in their communities. You know, we were kind of touching on that a little bit, but I wonder if you could say more, especially speaking more to our nation's current climate.
Well, I think they are doing one of the things, but not the other. So I think they're recognizing that there's a climate shift and there's a need to kind of be in relationship with that, but it happens in these two really fascinating ways. So McDonald's says Black Lives Matter, which I think is really ill-advised, because once you start to say Black Lives Matter, then people will say, okay, here are the terms in which you could actually honor that. So I think it makes them more vulnerable than not. But companies don't make these statements, or they don't take these measures without first doing a lot of market research and understanding the shift in the markets that they serve. So like when Nike, you know, supports Colin Kaepernick, they do that with an understanding of the market that they're serving for the future, even if it ruffles some feathers today. And so they're not, I don't think they're necessarily admitting to any fault in the past. I think they're just saying, you know, things are really tough right now, and we want to be part of the solution. And that lack of recognition is why it triggers such a visceral response from people within those organizations. So if you look at, you know, McDonald's has had a very long year from a lot of perspectives. So they have a racial discrimination lawsuit involving two African-American women. They have the COVID crisis. And then they have the lawsuit by, you know, more than 50 Black franchise donors, over $1 billion. And they're trying to put out, and they're doing this collaboration with Travis Scott to try to get more Black consumers. What tends to happen in these moments in which we have racial reckonings, responses are usually geared towards people at the very top of an organization at the expense of the people at the bottom. So McDonald's will probably do more diversity recruitment for VPs, for attorneys, and this franchise issue, they'll probably go and recruit more Black franchisees. These reckonings rarely, if ever, shift the quality of job, pay, respect of their workers, and that's where most of their Black and brown workers reside. But it's this really weird sleight of hand, because then they'll say, you know, we've really recommitted ourselves to diversity, and they have, but the people who are kind of most vulnerable to the kind of shifts of the moment, they get written out of the frame. And it's this like Jedi mind trick that's so effective, because when Black workers organize and they are employed by Black franchise owners, sometimes, according to my interviews with people who worked with Fight for Fight 15, the Black franchise owner would say to them, I wish I could help you, but you know my situation. Even I'm not making as much money as white counterparts. And so seeing the ways that racial discrimination is occurring at every kind of tier of the system, but some people have more power than others, but there's kind of, it's this weird negotiation then I think workers have to say, well, I know that my boss is also getting squeezed, but they're not getting squeezed in the same way.
Hmm. You know, in the early days, again, certain benefits that you talked about McDonald's, you know, not painting them totally as, you know, the bad guy, but as a good guy too. And the Black franchises were some of the first really to give work opportunities in a business to Black women. And that was, and again, isn't this something that, you know, other, that America policy should have been addressing? And can you address that somewhat?
Yes. So one of the great origin stories of McDonald's is that when the McDonald's brothers restructured their first kind of drive-through, they got rid of car hops and they stopped employing young women because they said they would flirt with the men and they were sexist. And so so women were not in the restaurants. And you know, people say that Ray Kroc didn't particularly think that women should be working at a McDonald's. But what started to happen with the growth of African-American franchises is that for people like Herman Petty and that early cohort of the National Black McDonald's Operators Association, they wanted to bring Black women that they knew and trusted and really understood their capacity in that system to come into the stores. And so a lot of the Black franchisees are credited with helping to change that culture. And the thing I think that also has to be noted is that, you know, this was during a time where this kind of form of low wage work could be somewhat sustainable economically. But what we see in the 80s and 90s, this great feminization of poverty for women who are heading households. We also see the fast food industry being used as an appendage for workfare, welfare to work. And we see an incredible number of women at various levels in fast food management within the stores. One woman I interviewed for the book talked about how she was one of the first Black women managers of a McDonald's and had a hard time getting a job because no one could see Black women in that role as a McDonald's manager. And so you start to see the influence again of the African-American franchise owners and helping shift that culture and creating a pipeline for Black women.
Interesting. Is there any other question at this time for the general questions? I don't see anything come up on the chat, and that's why I was wondering. Because we will break into smaller discussion groups so we can keep these conversations going. And it's a little easier if we are, you know, fewer people, and then we can talk to one another. And Marcia will come around and visit each of the groups. And so you can ask her directly all kinds of questions.
If I may, I'll just answer that one last question because I'll answer the last two questions because they're very funny. So Travis Scott, for those of you who don't know, who's a rapper who just signed with McDonald's a collaboration deal where he's doing both fashion. He has a new song coming out called Franchise. And I thought it was so funny. And Kate Taylor, who's an incredible business reporter from Business Insider, who has one of the best contacts within this world, she has broken every story about Black franchising since December of 2019. She wrote on Twitter that she is convinced that Travis Scott wrote a book, wrote a song based on my book. We'll have to see what it's like tomorrow. But this question of mom and pop diners, I think, is really important because we often think about kind of these massive retailers destabilizing small businesses. And it definitely had effects in a lot of the Black communities that McDonald's was able to produce something for so much cheaper than their competitors. They had access to a certain supply chain, and they also had the mechanism of advertising. And so in a lot of Black communities, by 68, by the early 70s, business ownership, especially restaurant ownership, was so hard then like it is today. And what people discovered was that Richard Nixon was talking about all this economic opportunity and Small Business Administration support. And what they discovered that it was really, really, really hard for small Black businesses to tap into those resources, and that franchises were really poised to take advantage of that.
Right. There is another question that came in, and that's from James Malin. He's one of our board members. And James, you want to ask your question?
Sure. I was just curious about maybe the history of the actual food at McDonald's and how that plays into this history, excuse me, if there was any kind of like forethought or care designated that from within McDonald's, or any pushback from the Black community when they were trying to be marketed to.
So there's a little bit in my book about this in terms of market research involving African Americans. There was a firm called Viewpoint Inc. based in Chicago, and Viewpoint was very important in developing all sorts of fast food products with the African American community in mind. And I use the example of the introduction of the chicken sandwich as illustrative of fast food's thinking about the product. So the original chicken sandwich was not a success. It was gross. African-American diners were confused by it. It had no bone in it. There was no gravy. And it looked like a burger, but it was supposed to be chicken. And so after all of this kind of negative feedback about the product, the advice was you don't have to change the product. You just have to make people feel special that the product is available. And so there were certain ways in which the introduction of certain foods or the framing of certain foods were massaged, but the actual food didn't change that much, which I think was really interesting. This same market research firm did a lot of research on fried chicken with Popeyes and KFC and all these brands. And the Popeyes conversation was really interesting because people took offense to calling it Cajun, and it wasn't real Cajun food. And it was really, really interesting the ways that Black diners evaluated these products. And this question about, targeting low quality, high calorie food to a minority community is nutritional, racism. I think that you can make an argument that trying to funnel consumers into foods that we mark as unhealthy is illustrative of inequality. But I also want to say this, as someone who grew up eating fast food and has found fast food very delicious in many ways, I do want to say this. fast food sometimes is incredibly practical in its consumptions because it's a lot of calories for very cheap. And it also is a way that people mediate the lack of access to refrigeration, the lack of access to cooking. You know, it helps when you work multiple jobs. It's great for kids who have to eat somewhere after school by themselves before they go home. There's a lot of practicality in it. But again, my concern is, what does it say about the quality of life? And what does it say about the things that people have to do to survive when we think of food purely as practical or functional because it's cheap, because it can fuel you up, because you don't have time to prepare meals, because there's kind of no life that allows us to have a lot of nutritional options. And so I think that, you know, McDonald's is reflective of the ways that inequality is not only kind of presented as normal, but then becomes a way that people can make money.
You know, I was in preparing for this over the past couple of weeks, my thoughts ran to very much the same thing that you were thinking, the practicality. During this period of COVID, for many people, they didn't have access, you know, food deserts, people who live in communities where there are no markets. Well, of course, the markets weren't open initially. No other resources to buy ingredients, to buy food. And probably a lot of these fast food places were the only access they had to food. So McDonald's certainly played a role during the, you know, the COVID period in being that it, you know, was takeout and they could get the food and take it out and take it home and eat it, which unfortunately may have been the only food they'd eaten for a long time. So.
Well, and also for people who had to work, frontline workers, people who are, you know, truck drivers were so grateful that there was actually something that you could stop and get. And so there's a great functionality in fast food. We just have to make sure that they pay their workers more.
I mean, who doesn't love, I mean, excuse me. All right, now it's time for everyone to raise your hand, okay? To make it easier, no, we don't want to spotlight one person, but how many have eaten in a fast food place or gotten takeaway from fast food before? Okay, raise your hand. Of course we have, all right? And if there's somebody who doesn't raise their hand, I'm gonna say, well, how old are you and why and where did you grow up? Yeah, it's something, you know, if not for the fun treat of it, then certainly for convenience or mom's convenience or someone's convenience. But yes, there are so many other avenues to, you know, to look at the food and the business practices for sure. And I think we have, somebody said, I haven't. Well, he's 29 and he was raised vegetarian by nutritionist parents. So that explains a lot. Okay. From Colin. Okay, Colin. Interesting that Colin, you want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, I can go into a little bit. I guess, yeah, just growing up, raised by a mother who was a dietitian and a chef and raised vegetarian. So we never really went out to fast food. So it was never really part of my cultural experience. I know I had all my friends go out to go and get it. And even then, as I sort of grew up, it was never part of my just food experience. I never felt the need to go out and go get fast food because I was just raised to cook food at home.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly understandable there. And I think Amy Bentley, you had a comment as well. We have Amy still here. There you are.
Hi, everybody. Hi, Marcia. Loved your book. I love and your presentation. Thank you so much. Yeah, mine was really not a question, but more. Can you that they often perform these functions of spaces, safe spaces in society for kids to go to school, you know, congregate after school and do their homework, elderly people coming to have coffee in the morning. They're really providing important social spaces, often in neighborhoods that don't have a lot of places like that.
Absolutely, and I think that that was very early. If you look at the cover of Franchise, this is a woman who's getting the oath to vote in a McDonald's parking lot, and this is actually the McDonald's in Portland where there was contention with the Black Panther Party for self-defense, and I felt like this was such a perfect encapsulation of the extension of McDonald's beyond a place to eat in Black people's lives. And you know, this idea of creating a third space is so important because increasingly we have to think about, like, are there places where people can be where they don't have money or they don't have kind of the price of admission? And, you know, public libraries are kind of it, public parks, but an indoor space where you can just be. And I know for myself, it's a really interesting shift. When I think about where do I meet people or where do I see people, it's to coffee, it's to places, you know, it's to places where consumption will happen. You know, this is a point that Mary Nessel makes about, like, we have to have food everywhere, in bookstores and libraries. And I think that then it sends the message that in order to kind of be in society, you have to have the means to do it, and you just do it at whatever frequency you have financially. And I think that, and I say this as someone who desperately misses writing in coffee shops and meeting people for lunch, but, you know, one of the other things that I wanted just to say about these spaces is that the introduction of fast casual has created some really interesting ways that we mark food differently according to kind of class lines. The idea that Chipotle is healthier for you than McDonald's is one of the greatest, like, you know, cons of the 21st century. You know, people will eat healthy at a Panera and not a Burger King. So, you know, it's all about another kind of market segmentation. And I think McDonald's clamoring for its Black consumers back is the fact that there's just a lot more options. Prepared foods in supermarkets can be a better alternative for people now. I talk about this endlessly with my students, and they're so tired of hearing about it. But I remember the introduction of rotisserie chicken and how that was a game changer. And now I eat more poultry than any human needs to, because now this is something you can have all the time. And I tell them about the old days when you had to roast a chicken if you wanted it. And they're always asking, why are you telling us this? But the point is that we get kind of reacclimated, and those adjustments have some real impacts on how we kind of mark food and what we think it does. You all know this. You're all, especially you, Amy, we're all scholars of the topic.
But don't be confused about that poultry. You know, those poultry for rotisserie have special treatment, which isn't the greatest. So
absolutely.
I hope they don't hear me too. But, you know, it's interesting because we were talking about the, and Amy mentioned, you know, the safe place for kids to go, people to gather. And Claire Stewart, you told a beautiful story just now. Well, I mean, everyone can see it, but if you want to talk about that, it was your friend actually who the playgrounds, when they came up with the playgrounds, right?
Yeah. I have a good friend who lives in Toronto, and she has three kids who are all very, very active, and she doesn't drive, and she is a very educated, very, like, on top of what's the right thing to do person. And she had days, especially before her kids started school, she just didn't know what to do with them all day. She just couldn't. And she didn't drive, and there was a McDonald's within walking distance. And she sheepishly admitted to, there was a mother's group at her local McDonald's, and they would meet, and the kids would go in the ball pit, and they barely ate because they're so hyper, they're tearing around in the ball pit. And she found that this McDonald's mother's group was something that made her quality of life much better. And she talked about it like she was embarrassed, but, like, there was nothing to be embarrassed about. She just needed to get through the day. And that ball pit helped her get through the day, and she could afford it, which is another thing. She couldn't have gone to Starbucks.
Right. Yeah, it's enticing things. I mean, their marketing is pretty incredible, I guess. And that's also, you know, the marketing to African Americans. When did we really see that growth of the marketing to African Americans by McDonald's?
1969. I mean, it's almost immediate. I should say this. So 68, you have the first Black franchise owner. 69, they're, you know, recruiting more people. By 70, 71, the franchise owners are banding together and saying, you know, we pay into the advertising fund. So every franchise owner pays into a national marketing fund. and we aren't getting any of the ads played on urban radio. We're not seeing McDonald's ads with Black models in Jet and Ebony and all of these kind of routes for our customer base. And so McDonald's hired Burrell Communications in Chicago. And initially they were just doing the thing where they would have Black models do the You Deserve a Break Today campaign, and it didn't quite resonate. And they were able to take over and really create specific ads for African-American communities. And what happens into the late 70s and 80s is you see a further segmentation of ads where there's what I call the Cosby turn, where it's a lot of middle-class families enjoying McDonald's. And a move away from blue-collar workers, everyday people in maybe working-class neighborhoods are captured in those ads. And in the 90s, you see a kind of return to that with the Calvin ads, which were really popular. It was so nice. Someone on TikTok, who is a TikToker, which I learned was a thing, she sent me a message and said, "I really liked your book, and I'd like to make a TikTok of it. Can you find where the Calvin ad was shot?" And some wonderful New Yorkers who knew architecture found the place in East Harlem where that commercial was shot. And I'm looking forward to seeing the TikTok. But all of that is to say that these ads were very high quality. They put a lot of resources into them, and they were trying to capture an idea of Black America that could resonate nationally.
Well, I think this has been an incredible presentation. I love all the participation by everybody. The questions really drove it. And if we can unmute everybody who's in, Christine, can you, or Kathy, you can unmute everybody, because I want to give, Marsha, I want to give you a big thanks. And if everyone can join in, thank you so much for your presentation.
Thank you, everyone. This is a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yay.